Hello, this is Wendy Bauer with the Decatur Herald and Review, April 16th, 2018. We will begin today's reading on the front page with the article headlined, A Happy Instrument. Friendly Decatur Ukulele Group meets monthly, plays for fun. Donette Beckett writes from Decatur, The ukulele is a happy instrument, local musicians say. You can't be sad playing the ukulele, said Renee Cadman, founder of the Decatur Area Ukulele Group. The ukulele has been a popular instrument for many well-known guitarists such as Eric Clapton, George Harrison, and Eddie Vedder, but that is not the appeal for many local ukulele players. Carl Leslie, 71, is one of the more experienced ukulele players. He owned one as a small boy, but didn't play it again until his wife pulled it from a closet 50 years later. Retirement and more time to play, and I have a lot of fun, he said. I learn more and try to improve. Those interested in learning more about the fun little guitar-like instrument are invited to join Decatur Area Ukulele Group, or DAUG, at 7 p.m. on the first Wednesday of the month at Door 4 Brewing Company. Members of the group say they attend the monthly meetings because they are enjoyable. From children to seniors, some are new to the ukulele while others are more experienced players. If you know two or three chords, you can get into a groove and play, Cadman said. Keith Benting, 62, bought a ukulele 5 years ago with the intention of learning through online lessons, but after playing with a Bloomington group, he learned of duag. We have a pretty good group here, he said. Ukuleles come in four sizes, soprano, concert, tenor, and baritone. I've got three, so I can bring a spare, Benting said. Cadman started Dueg in December 2016, and the group's first jam session was Christmas songs with just a few musicians. The ukulele players began with selections from a songbook, but some of the songs were dated, and we didn't know them, she said. The group began playing more popular songs that were better known to the musicians, from jazz, rock, folk, to Hawaiian. Their songs list features musical titles such as The Beatles' Hard Day's Night and Johnny Cash's Ring of Fire. Some of them we can do fairly well, and others are painful, but we keep going, said Cadman, who noted the musicians gather for their shared joy of music. We are not here for a concert. We are here to learn and play together. Gary Sims began playing the ukulele 2 years ago after playing the guitar, upright bass, and harmonica for more than 20 years. I don't play them very well, but I do play them, said Sims, who brought his baritone ukulele to the last month's meeting. You go where the music is. Members of the group describe the meetings as educational. Other ukulele groups have formed in Champaign and Bloomington Normal, but Cadman and her husband Chris had a difficult time traveling to the out-of-town meetings and decided to create their own group in Decatur. We can't be the only ones in town who do this, Cadman said at the time. The couple first began playing 6 years ago after Chris found a used ukulele during a vacation in Hawaii. He fell in love with it, she said. Cadman, 55, began playing the ukulele 3 years later. Her previous musical experience consisted of music lessons in middle school and singing in the church choir. She would often tag along to other ukulele sessions with her husband. Chris had grown up playing classical violin, but I hadn't played in years, he said. According to Dueg members, the instrument is easy to play with only four strings, and I have only four fingers, Cadman said. In a short time, Cadman has learned to love the ukulele as much as her husband. She is better than she thinks she is, he said. Sims enjoys Dueg meetings because of the range and experience. We have everything from professionals to intermediate to raw beginners, he said. I don't want to be a professional. I just want to have fun. For those who want to test out the instruments, members often bring extra ukuleles. Chuck Schankweiler visited the group because he wanted to try out a ukulele. He had played guitar in the past, so he borrowed one of Cadman's ukuleles during his first meeting. "She invited me to use her baby," he said. Schankweiler followed along with the other musicians. "I was succeeding and kind of keeping up," he said, "but as long as the song doesn't have more than three chords, I should be okay." Dwag meets at various locations throughout Decatur, including Brew Works and Doherty's Pub and Pins. As the group grew, venues changed, and it now meets at Door 4 Brewing Company. Ukulele players sit among the restaurant and bar patrons, playing and singing the music. Customers and staff have been known to sing or clap along. "It's either that or we drive them away," Renee Cadman said. And the sidebar notes that the Decatur Area Ukulele Group meets at 7 p.m. on the first Wednesday of the month at Door 4 Brewing Company, 1214 West Cerro Gordo Street in Decatur. The cost is free. And from the Bicentennial series, thwarted plans to steal Lincoln's body. One sunk by alcohol, loose lips. Another stopped with the assistance of a spy. This is the series in honor of the state's Illinois Bicentennial. It was July 3, 1876, the eve of our country's first centennial. Everyone in Springfield would be celebrating downtown. No one would be near Oak Ridge Cemetery. It was the perfect time to steal Abraham Lincoln's body. The incredulous plot was hatched by Midwestern counterfeiters who had been shut down when their expert bill engraver was jailed. Benjamin Boyd's bills were the best in the Midwest, possibly the country. In 1875, he was captured in Fulton, found guilty, and sent to the Joliet Penitentiary for 10 years. Without his plates, the criminals who made and passed the counterfeit bills were out of business. They had to spring their money man. Big Jim Canale, a St. Louis Irishman who led Midwestern counterfeiters, according to Thomas J. Crowell's book, Stealing Lincoln's Body, brainstormed a solution. They would snatch Lincoln's body, bury it in the Indiana Dunes, then ransom it for $200,000 and Boyd's pardon and freedom. His minions in Lincoln moved to Springfield to implement the plan. As a front, they opened a saloon and dance hall just a block west of the current Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum. When the criminals weren't running the saloon, they posed as tourists to case Lincoln's tomb. With their preparations finished about the middle of June, the Logan County boys relaxed. They spent the night at a Springfield brothel and toasted their upcoming riches. In his well-oiled state, the gang's leader boasted to one of the ladies that they were going to steal old Lincoln's bones and ransom them. He even told her when. She told the chief of police, who warned John Carroll Power, the tomb's custodian. He told the Lincoln Monument Association, local friends, and peers of Lincoln's who were in charge of the tomb. They did nothing. In a book he wrote about the crime, History of an Attempt, Power explains, it seemed to them so incredible that no attention was given to it. When the Logan County gang leader sobered and realized what he'd done, he and his minions fled. Whiskey alone is entitled to the credit of having thwarted this well-laid scheme, Power wrote. A few months later, Canale headed for Chicago to find new partners for his plot. He was part owner of a bar there called The Hub, which had little to offer except booze and boodle counterfeit carriers. Here, Canale proposed his idea to co-proprietor Terrence Mullen and Jack Hughes. They liked what they heard. The duo needed more men for the job, so they approached Louis Swiggles, a horse thief who had become a frequent customer. unbeknownst to them, he also was a spy. The assistant chief of the Secret Service in Chicago, Patrick Tyrell, hired Sweagles to hang around the hub and inform him of the habitués' criminal activities. As the would-be kidnappers honed their plan, Sweagles told Tyrell every detail. Tyrell then told Lincoln's oldest and only surviving son, Robert, a Chicago attorney. The detective asked Robert to let the plot proceed so he could catch the kidnappers in the act and increase their chance of conviction. Robert agreed. Mullen and his boys selected November 7th, election night, as the date. On November 6th, the counterfeiters caught a train to Springfield. In the back car, Tyrell, other detectives, and a Chicago Daily Tribune reporter were tailing them. Once in Springfield, some of the gang procured tools, while the others visited the tomb, acting as tourists to determine how to break in. They only had to break a door's padlock to reach Lincoln's white marble sarcophagus. That night, Tyrell and his detectives got to the tomb first. They hid inside and waited. Mullen and his gang sneaked up to the monument and began sawing the metal padlock on the door to the catacomb. They'd brought a flimsy metal saw for the job, and it broke, so they used a three-sided metal file, which took half an hour, according to Crawwell. Once inside, the kidnappers opened the sarcophagus lid with a crowbar and sawed through the container's front to reach Lincoln's coffin. They pulled it out about a foot, but it was too heavy. Mullen told Sweagles to get help. Instead, the informant signaled the detectives that it was time to raid the operation. The agents dashed from their hideout toward the catacomb at the other end of the tomb. In the excitement, one accidentally shot his gun. Frightened, the kidnappers fled. When the agents got to the sarcophagus, all that was left were the criminals' misfit tools. The agents spread out to catch the would-be thieves. Tyrell ran to the tomb's roof, where he spied a couple of men and shot at them. They returned fire. When Tyrell called for backup, one figure called out, "Tyrell, is that you?" One of the Secret Service's best detectives had been shooting at his own men. Stupidly, the kidnappers ran right back to the hub. Tyrell arrested Mullen and Hughes on November 17th. They were tried the following May. Since grave robbing wasn't a crime, the worst the two could be charged with was petty theft for trying to steal Lincoln's $75 coffin. They were convicted and sent to Joliet. After their arrest, Charles Conant, the acting Secretary of the U.S. Treasury, asked Robert Lincoln to pay for an attorney to prosecute charges against the counterfeiters and to pay Sweagles and another witness a per diem to make sure they stayed in the capital city until the trial. Lincoln agreed, but it appears he was stiffed. According to an article by Lincoln historian James Hickey in the February 11th to 17th, 1982 Illinois Times, despite Robert's many attempts to get his money back, there are no records that the feds ever paid it. When initial reports of the attempted kidnapping were printed, many people, even detectives and other newspaper editors, thought it was a hoax. Once verified, it was blamed on lots of people other than the real culprits. A few days after the attempted theft, Power and some of Lincoln's friends moved the president's coffin to the tomb's earthen-floored basement for its safety. It was moved several more times until 1901. Then, per Robert's request, it was buried 10 feet beneath the catacomb in an enclosure of concrete and steel. And from the local and state page, Governor's Mansion renovations continue. Rauner's to move back in next month, July 14th unveiling set. The Illinois Executive Mansion is continuing its $15 million renovation as the building prepares to reopen in July. The governor's residence has been undergoing renovations for the past year after decades of neglect, the State Journal Register reported. Improvements include making the building accessible for people with disabilities, adding a kitchen to the private residence, and installing new flooring and paint. We were engaged with the Illinois Executive Mansion Association in 2015 to kind of assess the deterioration of this building and what we should do with it, said Laura Hochuli, the project's head architect. Everybody knew it needed a lot of work, but nobody quite knew how to go about it. The renovation also aims to illustrate more of the building's 162-year history, according to association officials. A big part of what the association wanted to do was show the story of not only the building, but the history within, Hochuli said. The mansion will feature exhibits about the World Columbian Exposition in Chicago, life during the Civil War, and the children who have lived in the mansion. A project called Art of Illinois will showcase more than 80 pieces of fine and decorative art throughout the building. Governor Bruce Rauner and his wife are scheduled to move back into the residence next month. I'm very proud to say we're going to change it pretty dramatically, Rauner said Wednesday. It used to have an eclectic mix of stuff in there from Europe and Asia and different things. We're going to make it all Illinois, all day, every day. The association raised nearly $14 million for the renovation by April 2017. Updated fundraising figures have yet to be released. The mansion is expected to reopen to the public on July 14th. And next, Blessing of the Bikes, 26th version of annual event, draws in excess of 200 riders. Tony Reed writes from Forsyth, "The weather outside was frightful, but the blessings were quite delightful. And bikers in search of a little extra celestial insurance as they power through the Valley of the Shadow weren't going to let an April Sunday that felt more like winter than spring put them off. So they came in their many dozens, easily more than 200 in all, for the 26th annual Blessing of the Bikes, hosted on the grounds of the Cozier Harley-Davidson dealership in Forsyth. The sky was the color of melted lead, the wind snapped and snarled, and the low 40s temperatures added a healthy glow to the faces of die-hard riders like Michael and Kat Williams from Macon. The married couple sat on their top-of-the-line, ultra-classic Harley-Davidson, patiently waiting for their turn in one of the multiple blessing lanes marked out by little painted crosses. "We do this every year," yelled Michael Williams above the roar of surrounding bikes. "We want a safe driving season," said his wife. "And every little bit helps," added her husband. "Still, there's no sense putting all your faith in one basket. If admirers of their gleaming blue machine looked real close, they might notice a tiny silver bell tinkling away under the chassis." Kat Williams explains, "It's for luck. It's one of those little demon road bells," she said. "All the bikes have them underneath." "It keeps the road demons away," said her husband. The mainstream Christian blessings were handled by members of the Heavenly Chariots chapter of the Christian Motorcyclists Association, with some 60 volunteers from the Decatur chapter of the Harley Owners Group overseeing traffic control on the grounds of the dealership. Martha Kendall, 69, director of the chapter, said the blessing is a must-attend event for many bikers. "They want the reassurance it offers," she said, "and they want to see their biking buddies." "We enjoy the camaraderie, and we must enjoy seeing all the bikes, old friends, and getting together," she said. Before the blessings got underway, the bikers were addressed by the Reverend Matt Samuels, lead pastor of Decatur's GT Church, and the Reverend Brenda Nevitt, an associate pastor at the church. Samuels told the crowd he had some bad news. "As much as I study the Bible and read the Bible, I can't find anywhere that God cares about motorcycles, he said, offering a broad smile. But what he does love is you. We're here today to pray his blessing not on your motorcycle, but on you, his most prized possession. And next, many teachers struggle with second jobs. Hundreds of thousands of American school teachers work second jobs to boost their income. They speak of missing time with family, struggles to complete lesson plans, and nagging doubts over whether it's worth the sacrifices to stay in their profession. Nationwide, 18% of teachers work jobs outside school, supplementing the average full-time teacher salary of $55,100 by an average of $5,100, according to the latest survey from the U.S. Education Department from the 2015-2016 school year. That is up slightly from 16% in 2011-12. Teaching hardly is the only profession where people pick up second jobs to pay their bills, and many have the flexibility to do other work in the summer when school is out. But their numbers help explain the outrage behind the teacher revolts in states including West Virginia, Oklahoma, and Kentucky. The Associated Press asked moonlighting teachers in four states to describe how they balance the extra hours with their day jobs and family responsibilities. First, after a day of instructing first graders at Ulaga Tallala Public Schools in Oklahoma, Melinda Dale puts on a janitor's uniform and begins cleaning the very same school building. I usually do it right after school, Dale says, because working with first grade all day, I tend to lose my energy pretty fast. Dale, who has taught for 6 years, earns $32,000 a year as a teacher. She spends about 15 hours a week on the janitorial work, which at $10 an hour allows her to earn nearly a quarter of what she makes teaching. She is trying to save money for college for the oldest of her three children, a high school senior. Her youngest, a first grader, has to wait for Dale to finish cleaning before she can go home, but sometimes other family members help with the cleaning so she can leave sooner and spend time with her kids. Her second job forces her to do lesson plans on the weekend, usually on Sundays after church and lunch with her family. One day, her seventh grade daughter was waiting in the car for her mother and said, "I'm sorry it's come to this, Mom." It was a very heartwarming thing to say, but it was a sad moment to hear her say those words, Dale said. "I'll do whatever it takes to be in the career that I'm in, but also provide for them." Next, as Lyft driver Stephanie Lowe crisscrosses the Metro Phoenix area in her Jeep, many of her passengers are surprised to learn that she is also a full-time teacher. "It's super busy to drive during the week, but sometimes I just have to do it," said Lowe, 28. She earns just under $37,000 as a first-grade teacher at Toscano Elementary School. She rents a room instead of having her own apartment to keep her housing costs down. But to make ends meet, she drives for Lyft on nights and weekends and also picks up tutoring jobs. She drives more during the week when she has upcoming expenses like a car registration payment, medical bills, or supplies for her classroom. By 7 a.m. the next school day, she's back in her classroom with 32 students. The class demands her full attention, but Lowe is committed to improving her students' lives. "These kids are going to be taking care of you when you're older," she said. "Let's educate them. Let's make them the best people they can be." Next, John Andros knows the drill well after more than a decade of double-duty teaching high school and then working at Dick's Sporting Goods. He packs lunch and dinner, puts an extra set of clothes in the car for his retail job, and sets off knowing he won't be home before his daughters go to bed. There was a time earlier in his career when he was making less than $40,000 teaching, when he considered giving it up to pursue a management job at Dick's that would pay over $50,000. Now, in his 19th year of teaching with two master's degrees, he has reached top scale, $88,000 annually, as a special education teacher at Plainville High School in Connecticut. But he still works 15 hours a week at Dick's and tutors because he feels like he's still catching up financially after years of much lower earnings in an area with high property taxes and a high cost of living. And finally, despite more than three decades of teaching experience, Christy Phillips keeps up her longtime second career as a children's photographer. She enjoys working both jobs, but she feels like she doesn't really have a choice. 32 years, I have to have a second job, said Phillips, who teaches first grade at George Ward Elementary School in Mill Creek, West Virginia. Isn't that sad? That's very sad. Everybody I know has two or three jobs. Phillips makes $52,000 teaching. That's enough, she says, for her utilities and a car payment. The money from the second job is needed if she and her husband want to eat out at a nice restaurant, buy a second vehicle, or take a vacation. And this week at heraldreview.com/calendar, today, the tech drop-in at 10 a.m., Decatur Public Library Computer Lab. You can call 217-424-2900 for further information. You can get assistance with using a computer, tablet, or phone. Topics available for help: basic operation, typing, internet searching, email, downloading ebooks and audiobooks, MS Office, social media, Amazon, etc. On Tuesday, NOAA weather radio setup from 3:30 to 6:30 p.m. at Walgreens, 4994 East Illinois 36. Radios are available for sale. And on Wednesday, the movie The Last Temptation of Christ at 5:30 p.m. in the Decatur Public Library Madden Auditorium. And from the local briefs, police search for Domino's pizza robber. Decatur police continued their search late Sunday for the armed robber who held up Domino's Pizza, 1948 East Eldorado Street. Sergeant Dan Wise said, according to preliminary information, that a male subject with a handkerchief covering his face entered the store around 1 a.m. Sunday and threatened staff with a handgun. The subject then fled the scene in an unknown direction with an undetermined amount of cash. Police responded and stationed themselves from Jasper Street east to the restaurant in areas between Eldorado Street and the nearby rail yard in an effort to locate the suspect, who was not found. The suspect is described as black, aged in his late 20s or early 30s, about 6'1" tall, 180 to 200 pounds, wearing all dark clothing. Wise said there were no reports of employees being injured. Next, man alleges girlfriend stole cash. A 50-year-old Decatur man said his girlfriend, aged around 29, stole more than $500 in cash from him after she spent the night at his home, police said. Sergeant Brian Earls with Decatur Police said the man told officers his checkbook, with a wad of cash tucked inside, had also been taken in the theft from his home in the 1400 block of East Garfield Avenue. He reported the crime Friday afternoon. Earls said the man told police he had dated the woman for about 2 weeks, but hasn't seen her since his money was stolen. We'll take a short break now and return with the second half hour of the Decatur Herald and Review, April 16th, 2018. Please stay tuned.